foot out and bucked. Zinc sulfate water splashed Wills's jeans. He grappled with the sheep, but didn't let go. "Were those your good pair?" Salt asked.
"Well, yeah, I was hoping to make a good impression."
He smiled.
"Do all your dates get to bathe sheep?"
"I'm ready to clip the next one," she said, going back for another sheep, ignoring the sheep's chorus of complaints, pink mouths opening and closing on long bahas. They finished by the time the day started to really heat up. The sheep had all been allowed to escape to the pecan grove.
"That'll do, Wonder. That'll do," she said.
The dog ran to a cut-off water barrel under an outside faucet, climbed in, and sat down for a soak. He rested his snout on the edge of the barrel and watched Salt and Wills. Wills laughed and looked down at his jeans.
"I might join him. This zinc sulfate?"
"Yeah," she nodded.
"Will the stain be permanent?"
"The stains will outlast the jeans. I'm sorry." Sweat beads formed, ready to join and run down her chest. Through habit, she had started to unbutton the work shirt she wore over an undershirt, but stopped when she looked up and realized Wills was staring at her, with his mouth slightly open.
"The dog and I'm not used to company," she said, rebuttoning her shirt.
Wills didn't move or change expression.
"Wonder!"
The dog jumped out of the barrel and ran to her, shaking water all the way. She squatted down beside him, realizing too late that Wonder's plastered wet fur outlined the fresh scars.
"What happened to him?"
Wills asked, his voice heavy in a way she hadn't heard before. She dropped her forehead to his back and took a deep breath.
"Somebody broke in the house. He's territorial."
She tried to smooth the wet fur. Wills held out his hand, palm down, to Wonder's snout.
"Move slow. He's not much for petting."
They were both squatting down beside the dog. He tentatively sniffed the detective. The smell of sheep lanolin, wet dog, and summer dust floated around them. Wills moved the hand that he had held out to the dog and lifted a damp coil of Salt's hair. His fingers slightly touched the top of her ear. She quit breathing and looked down at her dog for safety.
"Don't make any sudden moves. He's wary."
"Salt," said Wills, just as Wonder sat back on his haunches and started a furious flea scratching.
She laughed nervously, stood and brushed her jeans.
"He has about the same amount of social skills that I do."
Wills, still squatting in the dirt, let his head drop between his shoulders. He looked up at her.
"I didn't even make iced tea."
"Give me a hand up," he said, reaching out for her.
"Do you have tea bags? Sugar?"
"Yes."
"I'll help.
My only pitcher has tiger lilies in it."
"We'll switch them out."
He took her by the elbow, easy, and walked with her to the house. The sharp, clean smell of mint cut through the outside odors that hung on their clothes. They sat at the kitchen table. Mint leaves stuck to the inside of the cold tea glasses. The flowers were by the sink in a tall canning jar. Wills looked good dirty. She liked the way he sat at her table, leaning forward, forearms spread.
"Wills, ATF, did the trace come back?" "I didn't come out here today because I wanted to work on crimes."
He pushed his chair back from the table, crossed one leg on top of the other, and pulled at the stains on his jeans. She looked down at her hands. Even after all the sheep work, two of her fingers were still yellow-stained from the lilies.
"Flowers, pollen," she said.
"What?" Wills looked up at her. She held out her hand to show him. He smiled and took her hand.
"We've both got something to remember the day."
He pointed to his jeans and rubbed her fingers.
"Salt, what about a report? Did you make a report? Does anyone know about your dog? About the break-in here?
She shook her head. You don't know how hard it's been for me to keep the Holmes beat. In general, women have to work harder to earn a reputation for handling their beat. Some command staff still automatically want women cops riding desks and would jump at the chance to reassign me. I would resign rather than take an inside job. He let her hand go and sighed.
There is a connection between Mitchell and Chanel.
Chanel and the man I shot? The morning light receded into hazy images of the city streets. The guns? She drew her hand back.
Chanel was a straw purchaser. Mitchell was transporting guns back up north because, as you probably know, gun laws are tougher there and guns harder to come by, especially for convicted felons. Chanel had bought two of the guns found in his trunk. The rest had been bought or stolen by other people.
She was a crack user and a prostitute. How could she buy guns?
She never had a felony conviction. She was perfect. Just under the radar for the background check.
How many guns had she bought?
ATF found 40 purchases she made over the past 5 years.
5 years? So she couldn't buy many guns at one time. Whoever was pimping her probably had other straw purchasers buying for them. Could she have been holding the guns for pickup, storing them? She thought about Chanel's red windows.
What makes you think that? Wills asked.
Sister Connolly, you remember, lives across the street from Chanel's place, said that she saw a car with New York tags there.
Some of the guns Chanel bought were recovered from crime scenes in New York. Mitchell had ties to a drug ring there that is believed to be distributing cocaine to points south, including our fair city.
Do they know who the connection was or is here? Salt asked.
No, but whoever is receiving has to be handling weight.
Then man does know, she said, bracing herself, elbows on the table.
You've been putting pressure on the Holmes gang, haven't you?
Any trace of a smile was gone from Wills's eyes. Obviously not enough. She looked down at a chipped spot on the table.
Who's got your back? Does Pepper know what you're doing? Does your sergeant?
His voice, low and flat. She stood and walked to the screen door, facing out. Wills said,
Let me do my job, Salt. This is not the way I wanted this day to end.
She turned to him. You're not going to report what I told you about what happened to Wonder and the break-in.
Would you let me come back if I did?
She didn't answer, just looked out at the sheep. He stood.
And if I don't let someone know, you will continue taking terrible risks. Salt, I'm the homicide detective. This is my case.
He stepped closer. How many open cases are you carrying?
I can make time for this case.
But why do you care so much about this murder? He reached his hand to the underside of her arm. She was the mother to a child I failed. She looked away, past Wills.
We all fail children in places like the Holmes, he answered. Why this mother? Why this child?
He tilted his head, seeing her close. I don't understand exactly, but when Mitchell's bullet scorched my head, something broke loose. I didn't know he had ties to Chanel, but somehow I'm not surprised. She looked over at the lilies in the canning jar beside the sink. The image of Chanel's kitchen flashed in her mind, an image of the girl, Lil D, in a green envelope. I'm remembering things.
It's my case. You don't have to put yourself at risk, Wills said.
Chanel and her family have been special to me for a long time. About 5 years ago, I got yet another domestic to Chanel's apartment. The usual. She'd cut Big D because he was ragging on her, probably about her crack use and whoring. They gave up their son, Lil D, years before, and then Chanel gave up her daughter, and Big D got fed up.
You know how it goes. Just another Holmes call. Big D bleeding, Chanel crying, face all smeary. I've already judged her because of giving up Lil D, and on and on.
Will shrugged his recognition of the scene and sentiment. So I trudge up those rickety stairs, 5 years on the job. That day, Chanel, snot running down her nose, said, I couldn't take care no baby. I can't take care of my own self, much less no baby. Something like that. And then she said, I didn't think a baby would love me.
At the bottom of the steps, Wonder lay, head pointed at them, as if waiting for the next command.
Wills made a soft dog-calling sound.
He still wants to work the sheep.
Does he ever just want to play, have fun, be a dog?
Work is what he's wired for. It makes him feel good.
Wills put his hand to the screen door and opened it.
You won't back off, will you?
Salt followed Wills to his truck. He opened the driver's door, then turned to her. His face different now, softer. She thought he might kiss her. She put her hand to her back pocket, feeling for the hoof clippers, only to find that she'd left them beside the pen.
Give me a chance, he said, and got in the truck.
He turned on the ignition, set his hands on the wheel, and, keeping his eyes to the front, steered out of the drive to the road. Salt watched the dust stir and blow into the fields. She weighed what Wills offered against what she needed, then inhaled to the hollow place that she was afraid of wanting him to fill.
Chapter 24. Red High Heels. The red high heels sat on the floor of Salt's closet like cardinals on a gray winter day. They were exotic-looking next to the dark navy uniform shirts and pants hanging above, bright compared to the jeans and T-shirts folded on the shelves. Strange sitting there next to the work and sheep shoes. She stood admiring them, then thought of Wills taking his time on the tour of her house. Wondered if he would have noticed them, smart detective that he was. He was on her mind a lot, and not just because of Chanel's murder. She liked Wills's steadiness. She liked the company of men in general, partly a legacy of the companionship she'd had with her father. She'd had one or two close, intimate relationships. David, a college sweetheart, and a brief but intense one-year affair with a state cop. But she had felt something missing or broken, likely having to do with her father's death. She understood enough to know that understanding wasn't the same as making things right. This was the third night of the John detail. She laid out stockings, a garter belt, a pink short skirt, and a red knit off-the-shoulder top. Getting into the blouse and skirt, she began to anticipate the shoes. She'd manicured her rough work hands so they wouldn't snag the stockings while she slid them over each foot and leg, attaching them to the garters at mid-thigh. She picked up one of the shoes, the red leather soft, the spiked heel, 4 skinny inches. In some situations, it might be a dangerous weapon. The insides of the shoes were lightly padded with soft leather, the color of butter. She crossed one leg over the other, pointed her toes to glide her foot into the shoe, feeling the arch lift first her toes, then her foot as it narrowed to fit into the high heels. As she stood, the shoes moved her whole body to a different shape, her ass more pronounced, chest thrust forward, legs longer. She'd practiced, and if her vision stayed clear during the 8-hour shift, she hoped she could walk steady in the shoes and not waffle or wobble. A small 38-caliber airweight 5-shot pistol tucked comfortably in her waistband was the only other accessory. Salt had volunteered to do a week with Vice in order to look for Dirty Red, who had disappeared after their first conversation. Working the whore detail also gave her access to information she couldn't get in uniform. Whores and police decoys aspired to a look that advertised body parts, not women. A look that appealed to fetishists and Johns seeking a particular sexual act. So she had gone shopping for a cheap pair of shoes, something Chanel or Dirty Red might wear. She had been headed for a discount store when a mall window, displaying the extraordinarily expensive red heels, caught her eye. She stopped, then immediately wanted those shoes, somehow reasoning that it would help her feel less like a trickster if she wore shoes that even she couldn't afford. Trying them on confirmed her desire, standing up to watch her body change in the store mirror, a body she would be literally selling for the job. She'd been loaned to the detail before, when they needed fresh meat for the Johns. She knew what was required to keep them interested and not suspicious, not letting the Johns get too close until the takedown, small bits of free conversation. You dating?
Sure, what you want?
A light smile. Get him to name the act. No entrapment.
What do you do?
What you need. Another smile. Not regular sex. Can I pee, shit, watch, get you to beat me with this, suck, around the world, butt fuck?
Sure, I can do what you need.
Still smiling.
How much?
What's it worth to you? A little sex in her voice. Get him to name the price, as the law required.
100, 50, 25, 10, 5, food stamps, a shared crack pipe.
Why did she let herself be seduced by the expensive high heels? All she had to do was step out into the street, and she could become one of the women on the avenue, unevenly lit neon signs reflecting off her skin, tinny music ringing in her ears. Even her perfume would turn and smell more like asphalt than lavender. Already she could taste the grit blown from the passing cars. A platinum wig added protection against being recognized and covered her itchy scar. Behind an abandoned skating rink on the avenue, she got out of an unmarked that she'd gotten from the vice unit's motor pool. She tucked the shoulder-length hair behind her ears as she went up to the converted bus that served as a mobile office for the PD details and was now parked at the command post location. There were other policewomen in whore clothes milling around the dark area behind the crumbling building. Even if she hadn't known the other women cops, it wasn't hard to tell them from the real street whores. The cops had better teeth. For several of the women, it was their first time posing as prostitutes, and the rookies were laughing and admiring each other's ingenuity at finding the right wig, or in daring to wear the shortest skirt or tightest pants. Salt smiled, waved, spoke to her colleagues, and acknowledged the requisite off-color admiration from the male plainclothes. They were bringing in the first of the real hookers, busted, so they could be replaced on the street by cops. The in-custody whores looked like wilted flowers, faded a long time ago. Salt moved her toes in the red shoes, watching for a minute, then decided and walked over to the lieutenant in charge.
LT, how long before you put us out?
Love your hat. He was a skinny, hyper guy wearing a baseball hat, which he habitually touched, the hat embroidered with the word John.
We got a late start, so I think you have about an hour to kill before we're ready, he answered, moving the cap to the back of his head.
Then I think I'm going to go get something to eat.
Salt's ankle turned and she stumbled.
Hey, don't get hurt in those great shoes, he said. You don't want to ruin your red slippers, Dorothy.
She gave an ironic salute and went to the car. So in the hour before the reverse Cinderella time, she headed back to her beat, back to the homes and to Marcy Street in the unmarked car. Parked, ignition off, She looked in the car mirror to check her wig, but couldn't see, so she switched on the overhead light. A fractured image met her eyes, and for a moment, it felt like someone else was in the car with her. She shook her head, careful not to dislodge the wig, switched off the light, and got out at Sister Connolly's. Looking down at her shoes like a penitent, synthetic hair hanging around the sides of her face, she stood at the door and knocked. Sister opened the door, wearing half glasses and carrying an open Bible, its black-grained leather cover soft and pliable. She closed it using one thumb to hold her place and narrowed her eyes over the glasses.
"You got the wrong house."
"Sister Connolly, it's Sarah. Officer Salt." The old woman took her glasses off and looked at Salt hard.
"My lord, I thought for a second you were a street girl. I couldn't see your face clear."
"Can I come in?" Sister moved back from the door, but only slightly.
"Why are you wearing that whore getup?"
"I'm working vice, undercover."
"You had me convinced."
Sister closed the door behind Salt.
"That where they send you when you don't do your job?"
"What job?"
"The other."
"What other?"
"You didn't arrest anybody for killing Chanel."
They were still standing close in the small entranceway. A tobacco and coconut odor was coming off Sister, still taller than Salt in heels. "Homicide detectives are the ones responsible for solving murders. I'm still assigned to my beat, but I'm on loan, on special assignment for a week." She had to tilt her head to make eye contact in the close quarters of the hall.
"Special assignment. Yeah, it looks special."
"I wanted to ask you a few more things about Chanel."
"What more?"
"Like, who was around her place when she died?" Sister led her into the dimly lit living room, to where they'd sat the last visit. She sat down in the same chair, across from the sofa, where Salt now took her same seat, careful of the short skirt. Again, the only illumination in the room came from the lamp beside Sister. Salt sat in the shadows.
"I save on the electric," Sister said.
She let the Bible fall open on her knees. A small bunch of dried flowers dropped from the pages to the braided rug. Salt came off the sofa and knelt to pick them up. Sister also bent to retrieve the flowers. Their eyes were inches apart. Salt looked down, picked up the blooms, and still kneeling, turned the little flattened bouquet over in her hand. They weren't wisteria like the scattered petals on Chanel's floor or tiger lilies like Will's had given her. They were rose blossoms, tiny, faded, dried, and fragile. "Are these from your garden?" she asked. Something was knocking around in her peripheral consciousness. The flowers were pinched together by a faded pink ribbon.
"Of course."
Salt handed them back, looking up into Sister's face again, while struggling to get back onto her feet in the spiked heels, and trying to keep her dignity in the short skirt. Slipping back onto the shadowed divan, she asked, "Sister, did Chanel come get flowers before Mother's Day?" Sister looked up at the ceiling.
"When you my age, Sarah, things tend to run together."
She shifted her gaze past Salt to the window behind the sofa. After a minute, she looked down, put her hand on the Bible, and said with flat firmness,
"No, I'm sure she didn't."
"Could she have cut your wisteria without you knowing?"
"No. Even if I didn't see her, I know my garden. Nothing changes that I don't notice. I put in every plant. Every day I weed what doesn't belong. I know every leaf, bloom, bug, and bird. I see the beginnings and endings, the causes of wilting and growing."
Salt sat in the dark, struggling to grab at fragments, trying to pull them together. "Mother's Day," she said to herself,
then pressed her hand against the wig and wished she hadn't. The touch made the itching worse.
"What did you say?"
Sister asked. "Oh," she pressed the wig to her head. "My head itches where I got shot." Her eyes wandered around the room and settled on a wall clock that was wrong, both its hands up, stopped on 12. She didn't have on her watch. Whores didn't wear watches.
"How long has it been?"
"What been?"
"Since you were shot."
"I was shot in April. The man I shot had guns in his car. He was transporting. He'd picked them up from somewhere around here." Sister's eyelids slowly closed, like someone who either does or doesn't want to see a memory. "Sister?" The old woman took a long breath, opened her eyes, and touched the little flower spray. Salt glanced again at the clock, which was right twice a day. She felt like she was also stuck and only right occasionally. "I've got to go, sister. Thank you for the help." She was anxious now to get to the car clock.
"How did I help?"
"I don't have it all," Salt told her. "I just have pieces."
"You talking about flowers has to do with what got her killed? You got pieces, huh?"
"Every once in a while, you and I are speaking the same language."
"But you not sure?"
Salt got to the door, turned, and asked, "You said that Mrs. McLeod is your cousin? Please, just answer me straight."
"Sometimes a crooked path leads you to where you need to go." "She is, but we don't talk, though I can't help but see her around."
"Crooked?" Salt, frustrated with the itching, pushed at the wig. "Is she good to marry?"
"Mary is looked after better than most."
"I saw that, but is she good to her?"
"I think she uses the Bible against Mary, not for her. But she don't know but a narrow way."
"Sister Connolly," now she was getting impatient, "I feel like I'm in Sunday school again, in the back row. I want to know if she is good to her."
"Truth is, I don't see much of that woman. Frances is her given name. She avoids me."
"Why is that?"
"We go different ways. She was too hard on Chanel. Now she's got Mary."
"Hard? How?"
"She put too much on Chanel too young, and she uses the Bible like a whip, like a curse."
Salt was at the door and looked out into the night. "I think so, too."
"She does what she thinks is right."
Sister sighed. Then she pointed her finger.
"You know what might be out on the street there."
She slapped the Bible against her thigh. "But it steals the child," Salt said, carefully placing her feet as she went wobbling slightly down the steps in her high heels.
"You don't seem like you walk too good in them shoes. They belong to you?"
"They're new, for the job. I wasn't meant to be a high-heel kind of girl."
"Watch your step, then," Sister called.
Salt headed to the car, its clock, at an evening on the avenue. Back at the command post, the last sweep of whores were being loaded into the paddy wagon. They were lined up at the rear doors, a slow procession, wrists bound behind them with plastic flex cuffs. The brides of the avenue, the crew called them, a wagon full. Some of the girls recognized her in spite of the wig. "Salt, Salt, can I talk to you? Salt, you know me. Salt, help me out here. I can't go to jail." All asking for a break, a trade, for information. "Sorry, ladies," Salt said to the group. "Not unless you got something to tell me." One of the women cops, dressed and ready to take it to the avenue, handed each woman a copy of her jail ticket as, one by one, they stepped up into the wagon. Voices inside complained about being crowded, about body odors, the police, and life in general.
"You look good, Salt."
Glenda stood at the end of the line with young Peaches. They were wearing matching outfits, red wigs, neon blue stretch dresses that barely covered anything, and black heels and stockings. Salt walked over. I'm sorry, Glenda.
Oh, I know the deal, Salt. I'm gonna help Peaches here.
She held up Peaches' hand.
Through the jail and court.
The young girl had tear tracks in her heavy makeup.
I see you found Dirty Red,
said Glenda. I'm still looking for her.
Why? She in the wagon.
The interior of the van was dark. Streetlight bounced off bits of jewelry, and irritated voices, amplified by the metal sides, jangled from the paddy wagon. Let me see what I can do, Glenda. I owe you twice now. Breathless, she walked up to the cop handing out the tickets. Hey, Stacy, have you got one last name Stone?
I'll look.
She sifted through the tickets.
Yep, here it is.
I need to get her out. I need to talk to her. Stacy handed over the green copy of Red's arrest ticket. Salt looked in the wagon but didn't see her. Then, in the corner, one very thin body was squeezed between two other women, her head turned to the wagon wall. Red! Salt called. Red turned, eyes wide, to see if Salt really meant her.
Red, come on out!
Come on, bitch!
Another girl elbowed Red.
Get out so we can get going!
Red stood, bent at the waist, stumbling to the door of the wagon. She had on a long black wig that was tangled and had barrettes scattered in it for no apparent purpose. As Red stepped out, Salt took a step back, caught her heel on a broken spot in the asphalt, and fell sideways, breaking her fall with the palm of her hand. Someone inside the wagon sneezed or laughed.
Shut up,
said another voice. Shit, Salt muttered, pushing herself up. Her palm was abraded, and little bits of dirt, glass, and asphalt were stuck in the scrapes.
You're not too good in them shoes, Red said,
her rictus grin disappearing and reappearing. I'm not a professional. She picked a sliver of glass out of the pad of one finger.
Damn.
Red stood there with her hands cuffed, nose running, her body edgy and shaking. Salt could have passed her 50 times on the street and wouldn't have recognized her. The black wig nearly covered her face, and it was like all Red's limbs had come out of joint and were just hanging by soft tissue.
Salt, you can see. Can you please get them to let me slide on this bus? I can't do 10 days. I'm hurting already. I stayed off the street as long as I could. I was too scared to work. But Big couldn't keep supporting me forever. Help me.
This bust is somebody else's case. I have to have a reason to let you go on a summons. Salt played it hard, way harder than she felt. She tried to brush some of the dirt from her palm. Red stepped forward, like she would touch Salt if her hands weren't cuffed behind her back.
I know things, Salt.
You know I don't need just things, Red. Red walked farther away from the wagon. Salt followed at her back.
Okay. I know about Chanel.
Salt just barely heard her say it. She halted Red by grabbing the flex cuffs. What about Chanel?
I know about what Stone had her up to.
The light around Red's wig went all fuzzy, the barrettes moving like moths in her hair. Salt started to raise her dirty hand to clear her eyes. Red seemed to recede, moving away without using her feet. You didn't tell me anything before, when I came to see you at Biggs. Salt's voice came out louder than she intended, like talking from a tunnel.
I was scared. I've been working for Stone. You gonna get them to cut me loose?
Salt's feet felt mushy on the pavement. She shook her head. If you give me good reason, and you're gonna have to make a written statement.
Oh, no, that would make me dead. I thought you were gonna look out for me. You're gonna leave me to get shot. I won't testify.
There's a good chance you wouldn't have to testify.
If the feds can build a strong enough case, they wouldn't need you. But I'm not going to lie to you and tell you absolutely you won't have to get on the stand.
It sounded like she was trying to convince them both.
Stone will kill me.
I can't get you out of this bust if I don't have something written.
Even blurry, Saul could see that Red was in severe withdrawal, grinding her teeth on every word. She felt for Red, felt bad for using her pain. Red bent over from the waist.
Oh, God help me. I'll write it.
Salt reached for the pen she normally kept in her uniform shirt pocket. Forgetting her costume, her hand patted the red knit top. Hold on. Let me get the arresting guy and get a statement for him. Which detective busted you?
That motherfucker,
she said, pointing at Gregory, one of the regular vice guys. Salt passed Red to Stacy. Can you hold on to her for a minute? She went over to Gregory, who was writing out more arrest tickets on the hood of a car. Red give you any trouble, Greg?
Red, last name Stone? No, he said. She's a pro. How you doing, Salt? I haven't seen you in forever.
I know. First the shooting, and I've been busy with the beat.
How's your head?
About healed, she said, instantly feeling the headache spike. Listen, would you be willing to cut Red loose on a summons? She's giving me good info.
Since it's you asking, I can go with letting her appear on her own. You get her ticket. You change it.
Thanks, Greg. I'll owe you one. Maybe two. You got a pen I can borrow? I already got the ticket from Stacy.
A freebie.
He handed her a pen from his pocket. Did you get Glenda and the young one, too?
Nope, those were Scrappler's arrests. You know you can have Red as far as I'm concerned, but the LT will stop that if it's called to his attention by you trying to get three whores off. You're bleeding, Salt. Your wrist.
Salt looked down and saw that a trickle of blood had begun down her wrist from her palm. Damn, it's these shoes. They tripped on the pavement.
I've got some hand wash in my gear bag.
It's just a scrape. Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, but out here you never can tell. Some of these girls carry some bad infections.
Really, I'm fine, she said.
Glenda and Peaches were the last on the wagon, so they sat across from each other at the doors. They had been last on, and so would be first off at the jail. Glenda nodded to Salt just before the driver closed the doors. Salt went back to Red, who was for the moment absorbed by the ends of her wig hair.
Who's got the flex cutters?
Red, knowing the routine, asked as soon as Salt got back to her.
I can't think with my hands behind me.
One of the men brought over snippers and cut the cuffs. I have your ticket, Salt said, leading Red to a car trunk, careful now of the puckered and split parking lot pavement. Red checked over her shoulder, rubbed her wet nose, shook her head like a dog, and took the pen and blue form Salt offered. From the street, nobody can see you. Red bent over and tried to arrange her body to write. She swung her butt from side to side as she leaned on the car trunk, her shoulders twitching as she pressed the pen to the form. Her body was in constant motion, joints bent in unexpected directions, head rolling as she wrote. After torturous minutes, lips pulled into a hard grimace, she finished, stuck the pen in her mouth, jutted her hip till it looked like it hurt, and handed the blue statement to Salt. The handwriting was childlike, printed with capitals in wrong places, misspellings and no punctuation, but it read like sacred text to Salt. Her heart rate revved with each word. Me and Chanel bought guns for Stone. Before she die, Chanel keep the guns at her apartment. Stone and some grill them. We can buy guns 'cause we don't got no felony record at the gun places. Stone give us two rocks and $25 for one gun each. After reading the statement, Salt felt as jangly as Red looked. but managed to write a series of questions and got Red to put an answer under each of the questions. Q. How many times did you buy guns? A.
I don't know. For 2 years? About 10 times.
Q. What about Chanel? Do you know how many times she bought? A.
Maybe the same.
Q. Do you know anybody else that bought guns for Stone? A.
That's not my business. I don't want to know.
Q. What happened to the guns Chanel and you were buying? A.
That's not my business, too.
Q. Was there anybody else in with Stone on the gun buying? A.
Less I know, the better I am.
Q. Is there anything else you can tell me about Stone buying and selling guns? A.
No.
Salt felt she had as much information as Red could give. She asked her to sign the statement. At first, Red started to write, Dirt, Re. Red, I need you to sign your real name. She looked puzzled for a moment, then wrote, Rose Lady Stone, taking her time with loopy cursive on the signature line. She leaned back for a few seconds, looking at her name before handing the paper back. Salt looked at Red's signature. Your name is pretty.
I didn't hardly remember it.
Her voice was soft.
I like the Rose Lady part better than Dirty Red, but I don't like folks to remember that my last name is same as Stone. I don't like that he's my blood brother.
Then her twitches started.
Now can I go?
Salt stepped close enough to touch Red, whose body held the street funk odor of the avenue. Red handed her the pen. Salt shook her head. You keep it. Practice writing your real name. Red's elbows came up. She clicked the pen, rotated her hips, clicked her heels together, clicked the pen again, turned, and started her stroll back to the avenue. Red's feet hadn't hit the sidewalk when Salt had Wills on the phone. Hi, it's Salt.
I know.
I found Red. She wrote and signed a statement about Chanel. Get this. Buying guns.
Where are you?
Detail.
Detail?
Vice, Whores and Johns.
Amazing.
She's a prostitute.
I meant you on the avenue. Damn.
I'll call you back. Oh, and Salt. How are you? I found Red. Wills and the agent were waiting for her in a back booth of the roadhouse. Over diners' voices and the sounds of dishes clacking, Jerry Lee Lewis screamed great balls of fire, spiking shards of light into her vision. Salt held her hand up, shielding her eyes against the bright lights of the faux 1950s-style decor. Chrome, neon, Wurlitzer jukebox swirling colors off the mirrors. Prisms surrounded the tables and booths in her path. Will stood when he saw her. The blending images that at times obscured her sight and skewed her judgment were getting harder to ignore. Wills looked like he was too far away to be in the room. It seemed a long walk to where he was, especially in the trick shoes. Theater patrons, having after-show suppers, seemed to slowly turn, watching her walk. She hadn't taken time to change from the work wig or prostitute clothes. She touched her chest, where the statement was folded beneath her concealed badge. The hostess followed closely as she made her way to the booth. Wills turned his head, scanning the room, watching the citizens and their attention to her progress toward him. Chanel, shiny and skinny, Red, naked and hurting. All she had to do was keep putting one red shoe in front of the other, each step closer to an arrest warrant.
I almost didn't recognize you, Wills said.
The guy with Wills stayed seated, staring at her shoes and short skirt. The hostess said, Miss, are you? This is the man I'm looking for, said Salt. Sir, do you know this woman?
I'm not sure, joked Wills, smiling, winking at her. She felt huge, standing there shifting from one hurting foot to the other, aware of the stares from the tables nearby. Yes, I know her, miss. It's okay. Wills laughed and slid over to make room in the booth for Salt. They had the back seat so they could face the door. Wills must have won the cop version of musical chairs. Until she tucked her legs under the table, the man across the booth kept his eyes on her shoes. The smell of the avenue clinging to her clothes, she tried to stay close to the edge of the booth seat, as far from Wills as possible. But Wills was his usual relaxed self. Everything always seemed easy for him. He turned to her. Go on, show her your badge so you'll get the discount.
I can't, Salt said.
Don't tell me you've worked a detail without a badge.
It's pinned inside my shirt. She'd been flipping her low-neck blouse, the material now stretched and misshapen, down all night, displaying the badge to surprised perps. The hostess said,
Well, if I don't see a badge, I can't give you the discount,
and turned and walked away.
It's okay, Salt said to the woman's back. I'm not that hungry.
Her stomach growled.
Agent Jim Thomas, ATF, meet Officer Sarah Ault, a.k.a. Salt, and tonight, Wills said, obviously, a.k.a. Hot Body.
He gave her a comedic leer. She reached across the table and shook Thomas's hand, remembering too late her sticky palm, still raw and seeping slightly. He drew back his hand quicker than she winced.
I fell, and this get-up was for a John detail tonight. You must have been very successful, said Thomas,
brushing his hands and lowering them under the table. Wills tapped the back of Salt's bad hand with a finger, then lightly turned it over, putting an ice cube in a napkin and closing her fist around it. She crossed her legs, one foot outside the booth. Her feet were cramped from walking in the red shoes all night, and she was trying to relax the muscles by arching them up and down. Thomas's eyes moved to her shoes again.
Great shoes, he said.
The waitress brought beers for Wills and Thomas.
Are you ready to order?
She wanted a beer, but there was already too much that was fuzzy, her eyes, her head. She asked for a root beer instead. Thomas and Wills ordered steaks. Salt asked for the catch of the day. After the waitress left, Wills said,
Salt is here with information, like I told you. I was just getting ready to leave the office, working on a big case when my bud here called. He bribed me with a steak and a beer.
Thomas reared back and adjusted his belt. He glanced from the red heels to a man and woman at a table nearby. The woman was watching the man watching Salt as she pulled red statement from her blouse, the blue paper curved and moist from prolonged exposure to her cleavage. One of the other whores wrote this out for me tonight.
Interesting filing system,
Thomas said. She unfolded the paper. Have you heard of James and John Simmons? They're called Man-Man and Johnny C. They run the dope gang in the homes. Wills reached for the statement, and while smoothing the folds, started to read.
Yeah, we know about them. We suspect they have ties to gun dealers up north, but so far we haven't been able to pin anything concrete on them,
Thomas said.
Read this.
She tapped the form in Wills's hand. Thomas took it between his thumb and index finger and started reading.
What? What is this word?
He squinted at the blue paper. Salt leaned over the table to look at what word he was struggling with. She pointed to B-O-T. That's bought. Then pointing to C-H-A-N-E-L, she translated, Chanel. She was murdered in May. That's... Salt took the statement back. I'll read it for you. And she began translating, first in Red's words, then in cop speak,
pressing her finger under the hair cap, giving in to an itch near the front of the wig. She felt like bringing up a foot, like wonder, and using the red heel to rake her head. She and Chanel bought guns, $25 and 2 hits of crack for each gun. Before Chanel was killed, she kept the guns at her apartment, and Stone and others grilled, that is, drilled them. I'm sure she means that they filed off the serial numbers. Salt finished, then looked at Thomas, and then at Wills, waiting.
How reliable is this, Red? Asked Thomas. This is only evidence against Stone, not Man or Johnny C.
The agent leaned back, dismissively looking down, adjusting his belt again. Salt touched Red's signature. Under the restaurant's bright lights, Red's statement looked less credible. Second-grade spelling, her large, childish letters filling the form, leaving no margins. The waitress brought their orders. Salt pushed her flounder to the side and leaned across the table toward Thomas. She's telling the truth. It was hard for her to write this.
Her reliability has to be established. Has she given you information in the past that proved true? You know how this works. I can't get a warrant on her word alone.
Thomas shook out his napkin, picked up the knife and fork, and cut into his steak.
But what about the information? Does it fit with what you already know about Man and Johnny?
Wills asked.
Yeah, it makes sense. Your hookers, Red and Chanel?
Salt nodded.
They're straw purchasers.
Thomas continued, covering his fries with ketchup.
They go to different pawn shops, gun shows, and stores, and buy guns, a couple at a time, and with enough time between buys to not draw attention.
He was gesturing with his fork. A drop of grease fell on the blue form. Salt picked up Red's statement.
I'm familiar with some aspects of illegal gun transactions.
She pushed the wig back slightly to cool the tip of the scar on her forehead.
They'd obviously be buying for someone else who sells the guns to a dealer, usually in the northern states where gun laws are tighter, or they trade them for quantities of drugs.
Thomas continued chewing and moving the food around on his plate.
Mitchell, the guy you shot on the expressway, was a lowlife. He never bought guns himself because of his felony record, but he was a known mule. We traced the guns in his car to straw purchasers in a number of southern states, including the ones bought by Chanel. But that doesn't tie her with Man or Stone.
Salt looked down at the shaky words on the blue form, thinking what Red had given up to write them. The grease stain was spreading. Wills sipped his beer, his food untouched.
Do you know who his contacts were here?
He asked Thomas.
You're not eating.
He pointed with his beer glass at Salt's plate.
But what about the connection with Mitchell? Why isn't that enough to establish Red?
She focused on the agent, trying to will away what she knew was coming.
We're not sure, but we think he'd been hooked up with Man-Man by some cocaine heavy in New York,
Thomas answered Wills. She sat back in her chair, silent. Wills poked at his food.
What is the connection between the guns and Chanel McLeod's murder? It doesn't give me motive.
Salt held Red's statement in her raw hand.
It doesn't do us any good unless we can establish Red's reliability.
Thomas tossed a half-eaten fry onto his plate. She realized that she'd known all along it would come to this, but said anyway, I told her she wouldn't have to do anything more, that this would be enough. She leaned toward Thomas. The table wobbled, causing the knife to slip off his plate, clattering on the formica.
You're not officially on this case, but if you want me to get this done, you have to give me Red,
Thomas said flatly.
Why can't we just ride in and arrest the bad guys? This job has no happy endings. All our hats are black. There's always a sacrificial lamb, said Salt, looking down at her hand.
Thomas pointed his fork at her face.
You choose.
She thought about Chanel, about Red's real name, about Lil D, about the boards on the door to Chanel's, and remembered her dream about building with rough boards. Wills was staring straight ahead, his eyes not on Thomas or Salt, as if he were listening, but not wanting to hear her decision. She dropped both her good hand and bad hand to her lap and said, I'll bring Red to you. Chapter 25. Wills brings dinner. Salt woke up early, already damp and sweaty from the summer heat, and troubled by a dream of a forest of dangerous flowers, spiky and poisonous, hanging, both huge and tiny, growing from the woven flowers on the rug in the upstairs bedroom. Some of the flowers resembled the crushed and scattered blooms in Chanel's crummy apartment. Another, a rose that sprang from Red's hair. Lil D stuck his neck out, and his birthmark morphed into weeping thistle. Other dream flowers, tiger lilies, like the ones Wills had brought, in time-lapse photography, wilted and faded. Anxiety and an odor greeted her as she woke. The smell of rot that had been faint a few days ago was now stomach-churning and intense enough for her to follow it to the living room, her bare feet leaving moist prints on the hardwood floor. Already hot daylight filled the air. The canning jar that held the bouquet sat in a stream of light, their stems mushy, leaves yellowed, curled petals littering the table. Most of the water in the jar had evaporated, leaving a chalky residue on the glass. She picked up the jar, and the odor of spoilage intensified. Breathing high and shallow, she brought the jar through the kitchen and out the back door. Near the sheep pen, she pitched the whole thing, canning jar and flowers, to the top of a chicken wire-encircled compost heap. An uncomfortable vision flashed of the seeds producing a profusion of volunteer flowers, a terrible bouquet from the fertile pile. By evening, the painted table was set on the screened back porch. The ceiling fan kept the breeze flirting with the edges of a worn, freshly laundered tablecloth, embroidered with tiny, faded to pink poinsettias. This time, Salt had prepared, had tried. Wender escorted Wills to the door, yelping with excitement. She let him knock on the porch door before she came out, wearing her best jeans, saved for special occasions, because they were at the fragile stage, soft, right before the tears at the knees begin, a shade of blue, just off-white. After Agent Thomas left them at the roadhouse, Wills had stood with her at her car. Can I come to your house Monday night? Before she could think about it, she'd said, yes, then amended with, but I can't cook, remember? He'd smiled and kidded, oh, I'm sure you cook. Maybe not with pots and pans. He lifted his eyebrows, Groucho-like. When she had turned to put her key in the car door, he put his hand on her arm. Here, let me do that, he said, taking the keys, unlocking and opening the door for her. She was surprised that she felt such pleasure from his chivalry. If you can chop up lettuce, I can grill. I think I saw a barrel grill in your yard, right? And so that was the deal. Easy for Wills. Easy Wills. At the door now, he looked up from a CD clasped in both of his large hands. Ray Charles and Betty Carter, he said with a wink, and handed it to her. I'll get the kebab. He left her, looking at the recording, while Wonder escorted him back to his truck. The cover showed Ray Charles on one side, wearing his dark glasses, hands lifted over a double keyboard, and Betty Carter on the other side, hands open, held waist high, a slender dress strap slipping off her shoulder. She was still looking at the recording when he returned, carrying a rectangular foil-covered pan. She held the door for him. He said,
Betty and Ray, duets.
Tofu kebabs.